Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this special edition of the program, we present highlights of some of our best interviews of 2014. During this year's UN General Assembly session in New York, we had the pleasure of interviewing UN Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson. Deputy Secretary Eliasson explained how he views the role of the United Nations in today's complex world.
Well, I'm a friend of the United Nations, but I'm not an uncritical friend. We need to show results, but the results, they come basically from the political will, the collective political will of member states. We just talked about the problems around Syria and Ukraine. When there is not a collective political will, we are weakened. So the United Nations is an expression of the strength of the political will around the world. What I claim in today's world is the conclusion to be drawn is that a good international solution, a good international formula, it's obvious in issues like migration or climate, when you really see the need for a collective international response, then the good international solution, the good international formula, is a national interest. If we can come to the conclusion that the work that we are doing here is in the national interest of the member states, then you would have a completely different situation with Congress, parliaments, editorial writers, public opinion, because they would see, yes, we need this international solution. And that's the rationale for this organization. I would say United Nations is two things. It's a reflection of the world as it is, and it's not a pretty place, but it's also a reflection of the world as it should be. Our job is never to give up the work for the world as it should be. And our job is not to close, because that's not realistic, but to diminish the gap between the world as it is and the world as it should be. That's our job. And I think it's also the job of all global citizens today, which are the citizens of the nation states of the United Nations. I hope we can move in that direction, but we have to, of course, to deliver. And as the stronger the EU member states support us, the stronger we become, and the better we help the peoples in the world.
Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson, I know you're working on a post-2015 reform agenda for the United Nations. Are any reforms on the table, in your view, working toward reducing that gap between the world as it is, not a pretty place, and the world as it should be, as exemplified by the highest ideals of the United Nations?
Well, the most difficult reform that I was working with when I was President of the General Assembly was, of course, the reform of the Security Council, which reflects the needs of several states who are playing a much more important role today than at the time of the creation of the United Nations. And I would hope that there will be a continued discussion about the composition and size of the Security Council. I think it's an interesting sign that France has suggested last year, and I think they are pushing the idea also now, that the veto should not be applied in mass atrocity situations. That, I think, is a good sign that there is a need to adapt to the new realities in the world and hopefully also the new moral requirements that we need to have when we see those horrible mass atrocities and even genocide over the world. The reforms that will come from the post-2015 development agenda is something else, and I think it's going very much in the direction of a hopefully ambitious yet realistic set of goals next year, which contain the need for us to still fight poverty. Poverty eradication continues to be our primary challenge, but we need also to remember that we, in everything we do today, have to build in the element of sustainability. We may have Plan B in life, but there is certainly no Planet B. And that has to be part of this new goals. And then I hope very much also that the new goals also will underline the importance of institutions, the importance of having a good, strong legal structure, that we have anti-corruption measures and so forth, so that we also bring in a quality development. But this is all in the hands of member states, and Already today it's being decided that the big dates next year, almost a three-day meeting, will be in the end of September next year, when the post-2015 development goals for the period 2015-2030 are going to be decided. Those goals will then succeed the very successful, I would say, although not on all counts, but many, Millennium Development Goals, which were established 2000 and finished by, going to be finished by next year. I personally, and the Secretary General I know shares this view, is perhaps one of our most important tasks, that we can show the world that we want to make a difference in terms of both poverty and development and lives that can be lived in dignity.
Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, Jan Eliasson. Garry Kasparov is not only a chess champion, but also a champion of human rights, and he feels very strongly about Russia's annexation of Crimea and the war in Ukraine. Here is an excerpt from the interview recorded at the end of September of this year.
In case of both Putin and ISIS or Al-Qaeda, we are seeing a challenge to the fundamental values of the free world. Why? It's inevitable. Because when we look back in history, we always knew that modernity, you know, was always a subject of attack from the past. There were forces that wanted to drag us back, the forces that could see modernity, technological progress, political progress, as a threat for their very existence and for the source of their power. It's very clear that free world, freedom of speech, liberal democracy, market economy, those are imminent threats for the power base of Vladimir Putin or all sorts of thugs who are using Islam, Islamic radicalism as an ideology to recruit people and to bring them in. There are always millions who are dissatisfied, disenfranchised, people who are upset, and they always existed before, and they were always made a pool of potential recruits by the forces of evil that wanted us to go back in the history timeline. But today, with all these new technologies that have been provided to everybody in the world, you can actually create not only social networks that are promoting good ideas, you can create social networks that are promoting the most unhuman ideas, the ideology promoting the heinous crimes. So among all of these threats, I put Putin on top because Putin is a man who is staying in power 15 years. We have to give him credit. He is a very savvy dictator. And I think, by the way, we have to call him what he is, the dictator. Someone who is staying in power, it's a one-man dictatorship, there's no political party behind him, he is the dictator. Russia, is it part of the solution or is it part of the problem? Putin needs crisis because, you know, his strategic interest is instability and high oil prices. It's exactly the opposite to the interest of the free world. He needs muddy waters to survive. So we need something totally the opposite. So let's stop telling Russia is a partner. Russia is not a partner. Let me emphasize, Putin's Russia today is an enemy of the free world. The Putin's success could be achieved only at the expense of the free world, only at the expense of global crisis and global instability. When we look around the world, it's easy to be swamped by this negative news. The problems are all over the place. But again, at the end of the day, we need our own strategy to respond. And yes, Obama is leading the war-weary nation. Again, it's hard to blame ordinary Americans. There were two wars and run, you know, just started with George W. Bush and continued by Obama. But the question is, if we look back, is the world today a safer place than in 2008? I don't think so. But not trying to just to give any credit for actions of George W., because in my view, what's happened, and that's not as simple, it's not black and white, it's not like in chess, you know, you have black pieces, white pieces. The strengths of the leader of the free world, naturally, the President of the United States, was always to pose a credible threat without using force. So in my view, the last two administrations created this very dangerous vacuum. They destroyed the credibility of the Oval Office by doing two opposite things. One president used force all the time. Another one doesn't want to use force. It's wrong. You have to pose a credible threat and you have to regain the credibility. While Bush, you know, has been using force all over the place, and again, it didn't help to boost American image. Obama has been drawing red lines one after another and reneging on them. By doing so, he destroyed the credibility of the office. Because if you show weakness by dealing with Vladimir Putin, with Bashar al-Assad, with Iranian mullahs, the only lesson you can take from history is that next day, it will require you to become even stronger. If you don't want to pose a credible threat today, and if they don't believe you, tomorrow you will have to start using force. And that's a problem. The weakness eventually leads to a much bigger disaster. So the weakness of Chamberlain led to the World War II, but there was a good chance that the strong response in 37, 38 to Hitler's ambitions might have prevented the World War II.
And of course, many analysts are saying that had President Obama and others in the West, the so-called friends of Syria, had they acted to nip the
problem. Two and a half years ago, when the opposition to Assad was secular, we haven't heard about Al-Qaeda or about ISIS. There was a popular revolt. By the way, today, America made a decision to support these elements. The problem is these elements, the secular elements, so-called moderate elements, they're in minority. 2.5 years ago, they were probably 90% of the force in Syria.
Well, exactly. They're in the minority because they did not receive the help at the time they requested, because, which doesn't mean they were perfect or, or there were
but
not
the
bad
problem
elements.
Is, the problem is, you know, if you have a crisis and you do not respond and dictators and old stacks like ISIS prevail, they create an environment where the opposition could be even worse. If you create a political desert, who can survive in the desert? Snakes, you know, rats, and the most dangerous, poisonous creatures. So same in politics. By slow reaction, by indecisiveness, by hesitations, we actually help dictators to create alternatives that look even worse.
That was chess champion and human rights advocate Garry Kasparov. Our other guest, whom we interviewed earlier this year, Ambassador Paula Dobryansky, feels equally strong about Russia's annexation of Crimea and about Ukraine's sovereignty. Dr. Dobryansky served as Under Secretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs, the longest serving in history, from 2001 to 2009. Now she's a senior fellow with the Future of Diplomacy Project at Harvard University.
I think that we clearly are witnessing a serious kind of tension. I do think that if Russia opts to pursue these aggressive goals further, I think that all experts will come to the conclusion that this is a revival of the Cold War. But let me also add something here that I think is important. The term Cold War has been used. But I think we need to be very vigilant to the fact that Putin is redefining the international order. He has targeted the international order as it has existed, the kind of legal norms that have been respected by all countries. And this is of grave concern. It's of grave concern because it does send messages to others in other parts of the globe that there isn't a respect for legal norms. There isn't a respect for international law. And we know that there are all kinds of disputes that are playing out in other parts of the world. So what the United States and the West does here matters greatly, not just only for this region, but as a signal to others as well.
And let's talk about your work on unconventional sources of energy, particularly here in the United States with the boom in shale gas. The United States is set to actually surpass Saudi Arabia in the production of oil and gas, perhaps in another 5 to 10 years. This has tremendous implications for energy security, for national security, particularly as it even relates to Russia. What about this longer-term strategy, trying to accelerate the export of natural gas, shale gas, to Europe? Is this viable? Do you see this in the offing?
It's a very viable option, and it's one that should be pursued. Let's say if the recent events had not occurred in Crimea and Ukraine, that this is an approach that the United States needed to be looking at and needed to be moving on. Why does it matter? First of all, I think those who are pursuing various approaches for an energy policy believe strongly that we, to maintain a strong foundation, really need to have a kind of diversified approach. And here, actually, by our providing and enhancing these LNG, liquefied natural gas, exports to Europe, it will benefit Europe because Europe will not be as dependent as it has been in the case of Russia. But at the same time, it will also be a benefit to us economically and also in terms of just our own, if you will, geopolitical strategies. So I think its time has certainly come. There's been a debate going on in the United States as to whether this should happen or not happen, and I think we're well past that debate. The time is now to really move forward on these exports, to diversify our energy portfolio and our energy policy strategy. And as I said, significantly, it's not just benefiting the United States, but it also is benefiting and can benefit countries like Europe that are very desirous of not becoming as dependent as they have been in the case of Russia.
And lastly, Ambassador Dobryansky, you were Under Secretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs. You have a keen view of the U.S. role on the world stage. I was wondering if you could just critique the Obama administration's foreign policy posture. You know, some have criticized that it's been ineffective, rather weak. How do you see the U.S. role in the world and how the Obama administration has approached crises, including the one in Ukraine vis-a-vis Syria, U.S.-China relations?
Well, I would first begin by saying that I do think that U.S. leadership does matter greatly. I think that it is always looked to. And whether it's in tandem with other countries in terms of solving a problem or even singularly, our voice, our strength, our involvement does, in fact, matter. In this case, I also think that it's important in many cases. You've mentioned a number of situations, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's Ukraine. I think that unity of purpose also matters. Let's take Ukraine. We spent time talking about it, and one of the points I made was how crucial it is that here it's a unified Western approach. It can't just be the United States alone. Here it does have to be the West together. That will make a difference on the ground. So I will say, I think, in sum, what we do matters greatly. It has been the case. It is. It will. But I also think a partnership, thinking through how you can use a variety of assets and partnerships and alliances with other countries also matters as well.
Former Undersecretary of State Paula Dobryansky. One of the most important and talked about stories this year has been the outbreak of Ebola and ways to contain it. In October, we interviewed one of the foremost experts on Ebola, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, Laurie Garrett. Well, Laurie, we know you're a renowned expert on Ebola. You've written two books, Betrayal of Trust and The Coming Plague. And you've also advised officials in the U.S. government. First, let me ask you, how do you think we got caught off guard this time?
Well, a whole series of mistakes were made. It begins with the fact that the virus appeared in three countries that had never seen Ebola before and that have a different hemorrhagic virus circulating naturally in the background called Lassa fever. And it, when it appeared in Guinea, the initial diagnosis in this rural area was cholera. So they proceeded as if they were dealing with a cholera epidemic. Of course, cholera is bacterial. You can treat it with antibiotics and oral rehydration. And it's not really contagious without the contaminated fecal matter and so on. So the kinds of precautions you would take were not taken. And then it wasn't until March. So the initial outbreak in Guinea is December. You go all the way to March of this year before there starts to be a recognition this is something much worse. And eventually two laboratories confirm that it's Ebola. By then, it has already crossed in this triangulated juncture area that's all rainforest where Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea meet. It's already crossed borders. So by then, you're in a situation where no one government can take appropriate action to stop matters. And all three are very weak governments, recently ravaged by civil war, amongst the poorest countries in the world, 50% literacy rates in the populations. So all of this is saying we have a problem and we're not capable of dealing with it on our own. The first big responders to come in were Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders. And from the very beginning, MSF was sending out alerts saying this is much worse than people realize. It's more widespread. It's not localized in one little clinic or one little village area, but rather quite spread out. And at that time, The World Health Organization, meanwhile, had had its budget severely cut, had laid off 20% of its people, and then most recently had had a vote by its legislative body, the World Health Assembly, to completely slash its infectious disease and epidemic response budget because countries thought, well, we don't really need this anymore. And the United States CDC, our Centers for Disease Control, would normally have been able to step into the breach. But the CDC had its own problems. It had a leak in its laboratories in Atlanta of very dangerous pathogens. A mistake was made and some virulent influenza samples were actually shipped in the U.S. mail. All combined, Congress was real mad at the CDC and was calling for firing the director, Tom Frieden, and actually ordered that the special pathogens lab, which is where you would do Ebola work, be shut down pending full investigation. So from late May all the way through to July, the CDC was out of commission in terms of a serious response. And then you hit August, and all of Europe is shut down in August. Mm-hmm. Everybody leaves. You're on the phone, hello, anybody there to help? And there's nobody answering the phones in Europe. So you get all the way to the end of August and the beginning of September before these collective problems start to get shoved aside by the sense of urgency. And everybody starts to realize, you know, MSF is right. This is not like anything we've ever seen before. It's huge. It's urban. It's three countries. It's out of control.
Well, I want to touch on something you just mentioned, that there's a lot of distrust of governments. These were war-torn societies. There's a lot of fear and suspicion of authorities. So to what extent does this continue to perpetuate the inability of getting this epidemic under control? Because some people are afraid. They don't believe what the government is saying, the severity of the problem. They don't abide by the quarantines. I mean, is this starting to change through education campaigns and sensitization?
I think it's been very hard for outsiders to appreciate how difficult it is to get health messages out, especially ones that are repugnant. They would be here. Just try to imagine in New York City that we had an epidemic of something that was incurable, for which there was no vaccine, and where the only way of protecting all 8.5 million New Yorkers would be to barge into the apartments and homes where we thought there was infection, remove your children from you, remove your husband, your wife from you, your grandmother, and so on, and take them to a quarantine facility. And if they die, deny you the right to be at a burial and to do proper ceremonies to pass them on. Well, that's what's going on. Now, you add to it that you're asking people who don't have a sense of the germ theory of disease. So you're asking people who can't read to understand what a virus is. But this is not what disease is in most of these cultural settings. Disease is about evil spirits, and it's about something you or your family did or your ancestors did to tick off that guy over there who then conjured spirits to make you sick. Now, you've just come out of a civil war, so just about everybody has reason to believe that somebody is mad at them. If you add to that that you've got both the local responders and the foreigners are wearing these outer space suits, and they're coming in looking very frightening, sort of our 21st century version of the beaked, robed 14th century responders to the plague. Well, needless to say, this has been met with terrible resistance in many places. At one point, MSF had to abandon one of its clinics when it came under siege. And most recently in Guinea, 8 Guinean health educators were stoned to death and their throats slit by villagers who objected and said, "You've come here to make us sick, not you've come here to teach us how to stay well."
Laurie Garrett of the Council on Foreign Relations speaking about the outbreak of Ebola. And to conclude on a positive note, we want to bring back an excerpt from our interview with Rachid Ghannouchi, co-founder and president of Tunisia's Ennahda Party. Mr. Ghannouchi paid us a visit back in March. Out of all the countries which experienced the Arab Spring upheavals, Tunisia stands out as the only country which underwent a truly democratic transition. This transition was reflected by adopting a new constitution in January of 2014, regarded as the most progressive in the region. Our distinguished guest was very much involved in drafting this historic document. So what I hear you saying is that it's your leadership, that is the leadership of Ennahda, which is the key ingredient and, as you said, the sense of moderation and tolerance. And that's very interesting because many are saying it's such a liberal document that it's perhaps one of the most progressive in the region, making Tunisia a civil state whose laws are not necessarily based on Islamic law, but the constitution makes reference to the country's Islamic identity, protecting citizens' rights, due process, freedom of worship, legal equality between men and women. It's really extraordinary, and one can say that where's the Islam, so to speak, here? But what you're saying is, on the contrary, it is deeply Islamic in the sense that it is a product of your leadership, and it sort of smashes stereotypes about Islam.
We understand Islam as justice, as equality, as mercy, as science, and national unity, the universal values. So it's Islam is not terrorism. Islam is not hatred others. Islam is not fighting against democracy, fighting against human rights. Islam is mercy, is just, as I said.
Are there any elements that your party had any doubts about or misgivings?
No. We accept all dimension what are we participate in this drafting this constitution, and we strongly believe that Islam and democracy, Islam and human rights are compatible. So since 1981, we try to deepen these universal values within the Islamic culture.
Rashid Ghannouchi, president of Tunisia's Ennahda Party. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Bob Doty. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to PCUSA@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.